And it is time now for Oh, the Humanities, taking a look back at humanities scholarship, research, and events on campus, around the community, and now a lot of stuff going online as well. Humanities.unc.edu for more information on Carolina Public Humanities. Go there this week. They've got a really cool thing coming up on Wednesday, April 15th at 5 p.m. What they're hoping is going to be a series. They're launching it on Wednesday called Talking Humanities, where scholars will be leading small groups online discussing articles, in this case about COVID-19, and contextualizing it in the humanities. About 12 to 15 people will be in on these conversations, so head online and sign up quickly. Those spots will go fast. Lloyd Kramer and Max Orr will be leading a discussion of a piece called The Revolution is Already Underway by Rebecca Spang coming up this Wednesday at 5 p.m. So again, head to the website for more on that. Of course, everyone's thinking about COVID-19 and trying to put it in some semblance of context, since this is something that none of us have really experienced anything like it before, but people have, and people have gotten through it. How did they do it in the past? For that, we are joined on the phone today by Brett Whalen, who's a historian at UNC, specifically a scholar of medieval history, and recently just published a new book called The Two Powers, The Papacy, the Empire, and the Struggle for Sovereignty in the 13th Century. Of course, when you're talking about diseases in the Middle Ages, we're talking mainly about the plague. So how did they get through that then? Brett Whalen joining us now on the phone. Thank you so much for being with us today.
Well, it's my pleasure. I'm glad I could join you, although I wish the circumstances were better.
Yeah, absolutely. And one of these days, we'll be able to get back to seeing each other in person, right?
Right.
Yeah. So we were emailing back and forth with Max Orr of Carolina Public Humanities earlier today, and he was talking about you and that you were going to be coming on to try to contextualize what we're going through right now and compare it to what they went through in the medieval period. And I've got the same stereotype in my head about the medieval period, the Middle Ages, that everyone else does. And I'm like, oh man, now we're to the point now where we're comparing what we're going through now to that period. But that's a stereotype. The medieval period was not as it was not the Dark Ages that people often characterize it as. So just before we even get started on the specifics, give us a sense of what life was like in the medieval period.
Well, certainly, you know, this is, if I had to pick one underlying theme of my my big survey course I teach, Introduction to the Middle Ages, it really is to combat some of those stereotypes about the Middle Ages as the Dark Ages. And we can have a whole separate show just talking about that stereotype. You know, it is, it's deeply ingrained in the way we think about the period, but the bottom line is every period of history has plagues, wars, horrific events, famines, but every period also has its share of achievements and advances and productive struggles. And I don't think the Middle Ages was any different than that. There is, I think, still even thinking, you know, the Middle Ages is like 1,000 years long, right? But I think the 14th century is still seen as one that had a outsized share of troubles, I guess you could say. And that's the century with the Black Death and the beginning of the Hundred Years' War. There was a famine. There seems to have been it's called the Little Ice Age. There was actually a cooling period that seems to have contributed to the famine in the early 14th century. So if I had to pick a medieval century to live in, the 14th might not be in the top of my list.
But
I think you're right that, you know, disease, the association of the Middle Ages exclusively with disease and pandemics and dire events, I don't think it holds up. But certainly the Black Death was an event, thinking particularly about the plague, it was an event of momentous importance for the shape of the 14th century. So I think it does make sense, beyond the stereotype, to think back to the plague.
So what was the experience of the plague, of human beings getting through those pandemics? There were many outbreaks of plague, that being the biggest one. What was the experience like?
Well, you know, something to think about. There's a couple of different things that leap to my mind right away. You know, one of the first I do think it's important to keep track of is the fact that the strand, I think there's like 99% agreement now among scholars that it was definitely a strand of the bubonic plague. And all the evidence indicates that the mortality rate was as high as a third to, in some regions, two-thirds, and it would be in a relatively quick amount of time. It was the there's the kind of the plague it's referred to as the pneumatic plague, which is a variant of the bubonic plague where it actually spreads through the respiratory system and like coughing and that travels really quickly. And so it's one of these situations you can read in medieval chronicles where, you know, people are waking up in the fine in the morning and they're dead by the evening. And I've been really clear as I've been thinking about this, not to minimize. I mean, right now people are experiencing, you know, their own losses of their family members. I know that hospitals are overwhelmed with COVID. So I think it's important not to, it's not like you're being dismissive at all of the impact of COVID, but there really was a difference with the Black Death where it would kill like half of a town in like a month, right? So I think there was a level of mortality there that even in the midst of the COVID epidemic, I think it's probably hard to wrap our heads around just how devastating the plague would have been on the society.
How did it change people's everyday lives? How did it change people's worldviews and way of looking at the world they were living in?
Well, that's a great question. And, you know, just the other day I was, by chance for one of the courses I'm teaching, we had a unit on the plague, this just last week. And so I was reviewing some of the materials that I assigned for that. And one of the things was Boccaccio, one of the texts is Boccaccio's Decameron, which, you know, Boccaccio is writing in the middle of the plague. He's a really famous figure of early Italian literature. The Decameron is a collection of stories, basically it's a collection of short stories, that's what we would call it now, right? Where these people had retreated out to a country estate to escape the plague, and they're telling these stories to each other to entertain each other. That's like the format for the book, right? But in the introduction to the book, he talks about the plague, and I really felt like I was reading the newspaper practically. And to give you one example of this, he talks about how people couldn't gather for funerals anymore, that there was all these people dying. But everyone realized that getting groups of people together for funerals was dangerous, right? And so you could see right there that something that was really part of the fabric of life, let's say, you know, the public gathering of a funeral, Christian burial, had been more or less suspended, or at least that was the intention to end it, right? And I know there's been discussions right now about the suspension of funeral services and the fact that COVID might have actually spread some early on through funeral services. So that was one thing I just thought, wow, I mean, you can see right there, people are dealing with a similar issue around death and dying, and how they have to change their behavior because of that. He talks too about how, surprise, rich people seem to make out a little better than some of the less affluent people, particularly in cities, that wealthy people would flee the cities, go out to their second homes, and the people in the cities didn't have the resources the same way that the wealthier did. So you can right away see these kind of class tensions and distinctions between how wealthier people and less wealthy people were dealing with the Black Death. And again, that struck me as being really relevant because there's been a lot of stories about that going on with COVID, right? And
Yeah.
this is not impacting every group, you know, the same, of course.
Also really interesting just in terms of who was the focus of literature at that time, because Boccaccio is saying that, and then his book is about people who are escaping to the country and telling each other these stories, right?
Yeah, that's the whole setup, for the book. And I think I'm not an expert on Boccaccio, but my understanding is that one of the themes that runs throughout the work is just the sort of randomness of fate. And I think this is something that struck people with the plague too, that Boccaccio is exploring, right? That there was no real logic to who would get it. You know, the priest that ran away and didn't tend to his flock would die, and the priest who didn't and stayed there and served his flock would live. You know, the wealthy people would flee out to their country estates, but they wouldn't necessarily escape the plague, right? So I think it really did have an impact on people in terms of seeing the randomness and the kind of, I guess you could say, you know, terrifying uncertainties of what the plague could bring about in ways that didn't seem to have any rhyme or reason. I should mention something I did illustrate, I did turn my students' attention to, and a really unfortunate aspect of reactions to the Black Death that I'm thankful we haven't seen a explicit corollary to, is that rumors started to circulate that the plague had been caused by Jews poisoning wells. And then this led to attacks on a number of Jewish communities, particularly in Germany. And, you know, I think there's a sort of sad and important lesson there too, though, that there might, in times of crisis like this, be a tendency to find a scapegoat, to want to blame somebody, right, for causing are contributing to the spread of a disastrous disease like that. And sadly, that's how people react in the 14th century. And I don't think we're exactly immune from that sort of blame game in the present, right? The China virus versus, you know, calling it COVID-19, just, I guess, would be one example that comes to my mind.
Yeah, speaking with Brett Whalen again, historian at UNC. So talking about the medieval experience of the plague, the Black Death, and of comparisons and contrasts to today, how did governments respond? I know it's a very different time in terms of government structure then versus now, but what was the response?
Yeah, that's an excellent question, and that's something that's been occurring to me. So I've been teaching at Chapel Hill for 15 years, right? Mm-hmm. And pretty much anyone who teaches a survey, a big lecture course on the Middle Ages, is going to touch base with the Black Death, because it was such a significant event. It's been striking to me to be going through this experience of COVID and watching the news and seeing how people are reacting and institutions are reacting right now. And it's getting me to think about the plague in the 14th century in some different ways. And one of the things that seems quite obvious to me now, but it really hadn't occurred to me before, really is the difference, right, in terms of some of the fundamental institutions that we have now that, you know, perhaps not surprisingly, we're lacking in the 14th century. You know, and I'm thinking of like the Center for Disease Control, mm-hmm. or the World Health Organization, right? The whole idea that there are these layers of government with federal, state government trying, maybe sometimes succeeding more or less, to coordinate efforts. There was none of that in the 14th century. That doesn't mean, though, that there was no response to the plague on a local level. And another one of the texts that I ask my students to read are a series of ordinances from the Italian city of Pistoia, which were an attempt by the local city government to more or less quarantine the town, right? There were rules passed against bringing corpses into the city. There was rules, as I mentioned before, about like attending funerals. There's an attempt to regulate the meat markets. I think for general health, but also in medieval sort of theories about disease, there's the idea that bad air can contribute to the spread of disease. So the idea that maybe if there was rotten meat or improper regulating, I guess we'd put it nowadays, of the meat market, that could make the plague worse. Interestingly, too, there was rules against people wearing too sumptuous clothing, actually. Like, I think it'd be seen as inappropriate to be out with the plague going on wearing, like, really, you know, outrageously flamboyant clothes or something like that. Like, that might be, like, morally offensive or provoke God's anger. I think it also shows a bit of this class anxiety.
I was to say that had to have been a class thing, too, right?
I think it was that, yeah. You know, there was going to be winners and losers with the plague and the idea that people might be acting above their station. You know, I was thinking of those articles about the people on spring break, right, who are, like, mm-hmm. on the beach when COVID's happening. And so the idea that certain social behaviors are coming under scrutiny. So, you know, this gets back to your earlier question, right, that people in the Middle Ages did not have a center for disease control. They didn't know what a virus was. But at the same time, they weren't stupid. They understand that you shouldn't bring corpses into your city. You know, they understood that diseases spread as people move around. So local governments particularly did take efforts to stop the plague in some really logical ways that we might recognize today.
Speaking with Brett Whalen, UNC historian, and as we wrap up this conversation, because we're starting to run out of time, I want to end with the end. These plagues broke out. There weren't vaccines. There never were vaccines. So how did the plague end, and how long did it take for life to get back to normal in the towns and communities and countries that were hit by it?
Well, you know, it's interesting because just this morning I've started to hear about some uncertainty in scientific circles about whether if you've had COVID, that means you're necessarily immune to it mm-hmm. after having had it once. And the basic sense of what happened in the 14th century is that the people who survived the plague did wind up having a level of immunity to it. The plague reappeared. It actually is part, and you know, we're talking now about, will COVID come back in the fall? Will COVID be part of our life for years to come? The plague was part of Europe's life for really up until like the 17th century, but it never had that disastrous impact the way it did when it first arrived. Because a lot of the people who survived it did have immunity, and so it became part of European life, but it never had that disastrous impact again. And I should add, there were some real positive long-term impacts in a sense of the plague too. One very quick example of that is that after the initial die-off, there's evidence that it actually led to some improvement in the condition of peasants and agricultural laborers because they could demand more money for their labor because there was less of them around. So there's this argument that the Black Death actually contributed to the end of serfdom and actually had a positive impact on Europe's, sort of labor markets, basically. So we don't know what the long-term impact of COVID will be, but the long-term impact of the Black Death was not, after the initial struggle and trauma, wasn't exclusively a negative thing for Europe.
You can get more on Brett Whalen at the UNC History website, history.unc.edu. Again, check out his most recent book published last year, The Two Powers, the Papacy, the Empire, and the Struggle for Sovereignty in the 13th Century. Brett Whalen, thank you so much for joining us on the air today.
Yeah, thanks for having me. I appreciate it.
And again, you can find out more about Carolina Public Humanities online at humanities.unc.edu. This Wednesday, the 15th at 5 p.m. is the first installment of Talking Humanities, small groups, small discussion groups online. The first one will be led by Lloyd Kramer and Max Orr. Get more info on that on the website. There's also another thing coming up on Thursday, the 16th at 6 p.m., Humanities Happy Hour. And this will be about The Sound of Silence, how musical survives in a virtual world. Again, humanities.unc.edu for more on that.